and welcome back to Story Collider's Stories of COVID-19. I'm your host, Erin Barker, and this is part one of episode 5 on the theme of generations. I don't know about you, but for the past few months, I've been experiencing that surreal feeling of living a moment in history. Something you know you will, as the saying goes, tell your grandkids about someday. And when I heard our first story today, it made me realize that some of us have already heard stories like these from our grandparents about surviving pandemics. And even more than that, some of us are already carrying that weight with us. Some of us are already driven by the memory of pandemics past. In part one of this episode, we'll hear a story about this, and then we'll talk to science historian Marta Hansen about how we've responded to pandemics of the past. Our first story is from Mary Sue Kitchen, who was director of the Fairfax County Health Department Laboratory for 17 years. The story was recorded at her home in Vienna, Virginia, and was originally developed for a live online show we produced in partnership with the American Public Health Laboratories.
In January of 2012, I was in Atlanta in the Emergency Operations Center of the Centers for Disease Control as part of a special tour arranged for the board of the Association of Public Health Laboratories. I was watching a live worldwide tally of infectious disease on a huge world map at the head of the room. I felt secure, prepared, proud of our nation and of our world for the great strides made in public health and in emergency preparedness in recent years. I reflected on my 40-year career in laboratory medicine, in particular, the past 20 years spent working in a local public health laboratory next to the nation's capital. Our laboratory routinely dealt with pathogens like tuberculosis, HIV, West Nile virus, and rabies. And we had just built a new public health laboratory with a special molecular biology section prepared to rapidly identify emerging pathogens in the future. I thought back to a story told by my grandmother in my childhood that had inspired my career. When I was 8 years old, our family moved from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Lincoln, Nebraska. We lived with my grandparents for a few months. One morning in the summer of 1955, when I was home alone with my grandmother, I tripped at the top of a dangerous back stairway and fell head over heels down the stairs, gashing my leg severely and crashing headfirst into kitchen cabinets at the base of the stairs. As my grandmother tended to my wounds, she comforted me with a story of the part those stairs had played in the survival of her family many years earlier, during the influenza epidemic of 1918. It had started in the spring of that year. By May, her elderly neighbors had both died of influenza. My worried grandfather sent my grandmother and my 4-year-old father to isolate with distant relatives on a remote Nebraska farm for a few months. They were eager to return home when school started in the fall. By October, all three of them had come down with influenza at about the same time. My grandmother was so sick, she was unable to get out of bed. She awoke after several days to the sound of my father crying from hunger in the next room. She crawled on her hands and knees up and down those same stairs that I had just fallen down to feed her family, too sick and too weak to even stand. They survived on not much more than jugs of milk poured over saltine crackers for the next few weeks. I listened to her story as she bandaged my leg. The bleeding stopped, the pain receded, but the story stayed. Why have I remembered it through all these years? I think because that morning, as we sat on that kitchen floor, propped against the kitchen cupboards, both of us were crying out of fear and relief. I think my grandmother cried out of that fear universal to parents, the fear of failing one's children. After all, she had just failed to prevent me from falling down those dangerous stairs, and she had relived the most fearful story of her life, the time that she was so sick she had failed to feed her only child. I cried out of relief that I had avoided stitches and broken bones, but also frightened by her unaccustomed tears and by the dread disease that had caused her fear. Years later, as I sat in that CDC conference room, I thought my grandmother might be proud of my career and of what our country had accomplished over the years to better prepare for future pandemics. It seemed a good time for me to retire. When COVID-19 arrived this spring, 8 years into my retirement, my husband and I decided to isolate here at home for a few months until public health got things under control. I've been frequently disappointed and angry these past few months. I was totally shocked when federal control of the epidemic was delegated to the states in early May. Every public health plan I had ever written depended on a close coordination between local, state, and national public health resources. This was not the public health system I had retired from. I had nightmares about laboratories in 50 different states bidding against each other for scarce and complicated molecular diagnostics with no federal coordination or purchasing assistance. If laboratory stockrooms currently looked anything like the pandemic hodgepodge in my garage, Lord help us all. So where does all this confusion and lack of coordination leave me and my family? My grandmother came home from the farm too soon in 1918. So my husband and I practiced strict isolation due to our age and multiple risk factors. We are lonely because our children and grandchildren all live far away in distant states. Our family and friends are confused by different and conflicting messages from a myriad of different news sources with no clear national risk coordination and communication. Right now, despite a century of cutting-edge science, I feel abandoned by my nation and not much better off than my grandmother 100 years ago. I worry about my valiant lab colleagues right down the street when I hear reports of extended shifts and instrument and reagent shortages. I offer to help and then feel guilty when I reconsider and decide not to help. Not sure I should risk such close exposure to coworkers, both for my husband's sake as well as my own. I do feel lucky that I have retired in a county and a state with a good public health system, and I can vote, something my grandmother could not do in 1918. Each of us have been left largely alone these days to navigate a confusing path between risk and responsibility. One evening last week, several neighbors invited us to a socially distanced lawn party. I started to join in and then thought of my grandmother in 1918. I paused briefly by an open window. Soft laughter, lawn chairs spaced well apart, fireflies in the dusk, dogs playing catch. I looked again at all my dear neighbors, some gathered way too close together under a street lamp, only a few wearing masks. I watched their dogs ferry a saliva-covered ball from hand to hand to hand across the lawn. That night, I decided to stay inside.
That was Mary Sue Kitchen. Mary Sue was director of the Fairfax County Health Department Laboratory for 17 years, from 1995 to 2012. The laboratory provides public health testing to a population of over 1 million people in the Washington, D.C. metro area. On the national level, Mary Sue served on the board of the Association of Public Health Laboratories, as well as the Infectious Disease Committee. Her career spans 40 years in laboratory medicine. Before we move on to our interview segment, just a quick reminder that you can catch more true personal stories about science at our live online shows. Find out more about those at storyclutter.org, where you can also find out more about our online storytelling workshops. We have a new workshop open every month, as well as advanced elective courses that you can sign up for. Check those out, storyclutter.org/workshops. If you're listening to this series thinking that you have a story about how the pandemic has affected you in a big or small way, get in touch. You can send your story pitches to stories@storyclutter.org, or you can pitch through the form on our website. We're currently working on our next series of COVID-19 stories, and we would love to work with you on yours.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When I heard Mary Sue's story, it made me think about the fact that this isn't the first time humanity has endured a pandemic, even in some of our lifetimes. And I couldn't help but wonder, did we make the same mistakes then that we're making now? What lessons can we learn? So I was excited to talk to historian Marta Hansen. Marta is an associate professor of the history of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. So to talk about pandemics of the past, we're joined by Dr. Marta Hansen, a historian of medicine at Johns Hopkins University, who has a particular focus on Chinese science and medicine. Welcome, Marta.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for chatting with me today. So I'm really excited to talk to you, a historian, about this because I think all of us are really curious. Those of us who have never experienced a pandemic or an epidemic of this scale before in our lifetimes, we're really curious how this compares in the grand scheme of things. What's your sense of how catastrophic this pandemic is compared to pandemics of the past?
I think it's comparable. I think that when you look at it from a historical point of view, there's many sources that of humans and all over the world. In the Greek tradition, we have very early accounting, for example, by Thucydides. They're dealing with the first plague pandemic in the mid 6th through mid 8th century, when waves in over 200 years. China is the many responses to catastrophic events like this. So there's religious responses, there's state responses, there's individual responses, there's blaming others and not taking responsibility. And there's all these are patterns that we see in previous responses to pandemic. And we're, you know, it's, maybe it's comforting as a historian to see, oh, we've been through this before. And then there's how to negotiate public response. So do you have transparency or lack of transparency? Do you try to control, you know, not give all the information you have in order for the public not to go into panic, right? This is, we see this again and again and again repeating itself, and it's no different than the current administration.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to ask about is how have government responses in the past compared to the government response that we're seeing today?
There are similar patterns. Similar lack of transparency of what's going on, not wanting to get the public panicked about it, holding back information. I think it's not just the past, it's in the present in other countries and other places too, that trying to manage public response by not revealing all the information. And even hiding numbers or lowering numbers. I mean, this is a big problem right now where what numbers can we trust when you have an administration that it's not in their political interest to track? Well, I find it really disturbing to think that for the 1918 influenza pandemic, the numbers range from a low estimate of 50 million to a higher estimate of 100 million in the world, 675,000 in the United States. And I know for a fact that my great aunt was not in that number, so they're probably even more in the United States. Now, one of the reasons for that is they had a difficulty tracking the dead when the healthcare infrastructure was, you know, having a hard enough time just taking care of the sick, right? So I have understanding and compassion for that. But then there's the problem where we have today where there's lack of a top-down federal effort to do proper tracking and accounting of morbidity and mortality. And that I find really egregious and problematic, yeah.
I was going to ask you about the way the public is responding compared to pandemics past, because I was thinking about, you mentioned scapegoating or blaming others earlier, and I think that we have seen a little bit of that as well.
We've seen a lot of scapegoating of China. I mean, they're even, they blame it on the China virus or the Wuhan virus. And that, I think, is just one way of deflecting responsibility from the failures of the current administration. And it's not productive to do. But also, epidemics are known to come from the outside. So there's a long history of calling them, you know, the Spanish flu actually wasn't from Spain or anything. It's just that it was the Spanish news that was reporting on it, because the other countries during the World War I were not allowed to report on it. So you see there is a lack of, you know, transparency then because of the war effort. So there are similar political reasons in the past why such epidemics or pandemics aren't properly recorded and tracked at the time that we see today in being politicized. And even masks. I mean, masks were a big political issue in the 1918 influenza pandemic, as they are today. And
really?
Probably, yeah. Today, probably even more politicized than intentionally politicized than it had been then. But yeah, people were really resistant to wearing them. They had individual rights to choose or not to choose and adjust according to their own sense of risk, not at all really thinking about the community. I like to talk about, when I talk about these things, COVID consciousness. And so I think of COVID consciousness requiring contagion consciousness. That is the science of that contagion. So people understand that what an airborne virus is like and how it can spread so quickly, which is really essential for understanding why it's important to wear a mask to protect others from you, you know, and protect our elders from the younger, that they're people that are more susceptible. So that's, I think, important to see as part of COVID consciousness. And the other one is what I call China consciousness, because in this particular political milieu, China is the scapegoat against which the failures of the current administration to control COVID are being projected, right? So it's China's to blame original. They didn't, you know, they didn't do this, didn't do that. It's the origin. All of these kinds of xenophobic, cynical ways of framing it. I also find it's important to understand why it's being framed that way and what kind of nefarious work it's doing politically. My history is very informative at this moment. My fellow medical historians are very busy right now responding and showing historical precedents and examples, things that didn't work well in the past that we also see in the present, and how can we, you know, what, you know, prove things in the present, or at least make some kind of historical inside intervention so that we can do better wherever we're placed. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I find doing history so important at this moment, especially
yeah.
medical history.
Yeah.
But what I also wanted to say, I mean, that's a diachronic perspective on our present, that there is a pattern to epidemics, you know, that there's a progressive revelation. There's a certain way of managing the randomness, how to negotiate public response, you know, different. And also it will end, and then there will be a time of retrospection. I don't think we're going to really understand all the complexity of what's going on for the next decade. But it's comforting to know that to know that there's a script in advance. And I think it can help us facilitate how we perform or anticipate or choose a role we want to take into our present, where we're positioned. You know, what are the steps we can take each individual to march into the future that we would like to see, a post-COVID future. And I find that comforting in doing history of medicine, because you get a sense of what that script is, what it looks like. We've been here before. And then how can I, you know, intervene and help other people find a sense of agency in their lives?
Yeah. Are there any of those lessons that you'd like to share with us, aside from those that you already have?
I think the main thing is to understand that we're in this together, that this is an issue of human experience, and that we are collectively responsible for each other, and not to sink into despair, but to find agency wherever one can find it that's appropriate for each individual. And I think that's an individual decision. I think it's a time of a revelation. And so this virus and our response to it is uncovering a lot of things, undoubtedly, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just uncovering systemic racism and healthcare disparities and all the really ugly things about our contemporary society.
I'm a little bit curious as well, what life was like for normal people during the pandemic's past, because presumably they couldn't all work from home. They couldn't communicate on Zoom. How did they cope during pandemics?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the wealthy fled, just like we saw, like we see now, actually. The wealthy are buying homes in, you know, outside of major cities, or buying second houses. We saw Italy early on, the wealthy going to their second houses in the south or on Sardinia and getting out of the major city. So that's one major thing that we see happening. Those who have means just leave the urban areas where the epidemics tend to be concentrated. And those who can't do that try to stay in, or, you know, avoid contact with other people. And unfortunately, it's just like we see today, there are those who just don't have the possibilities of doing that and are therefore more exposed and more likely to die from the epidemics, and therefore get blamed as the carriers, when in fact it's more a structural problem of socioeconomic inequalities that place them in more vulnerable positions of exposure. And I mean, we also see comparable recourses to religion in positive and negative ways. Finding some solace in a community that is good, but also finding a rhetoric of blaming or putting the blame on others, or finding some kind of divine cause for this rather than looking at what we would call a more scientific approach.
Wow, the similarities on kind of every level are pretty remarkable. I'm wondering, is there anything about this particular pandemic that is different compared to pandemics of the past?
I find, one, the circulation of the disease is much more facilitated because of our global transportation system, I guess.
Yeah.
And also the media is so much more developed than it was earlier. So there's so much more misinformation and politicizing, and I just call it noise, maybe, than before. So many alternate realities about it. Such a multiplicity of perspectives, I guess, so because of the multiple media outlets that have developed. I think that's really different. What is another really striking difference? I think it's just shocking how the administration is just flaunting science. I think before, when there was science, it was valued as a, you know, resource to use, and here it's just so politicized in such a disturbing way. I don't remember or recall a time when that has been so starkly true. I mean, it's shocking.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe it has to do with the politicization of the situation. The fact that science has been politicized for the past decade or so, at least.
Yeah, and there's been a real skepticism toward intellectuals or science and all that kind of thing. And maybe the silver lining will be that people will, some greater percentage of people will have what I call contagion consciousness, at least some respect for the science behind these kinds of epidemic diseases, because this is, well, in my humble opinion, it's not going to be our first pandemic. I think we're going into an age of pandemics. I think our new norm is going to be wearing masks. I don't think we're ever going to go back to shaking hands, except for political. I mean, maybe that's clearly highly politicized now too. But hugging, the French kissing on both sides of the cheek, shaking hands with strangers. I just think all of those things are going to be, I don't think we're going back to them. At least some people won't be going back to them.
Wow.
I think we're going into a pandemic century. I guess I said that already, but yes.
If we're facing down an age of pandemics, let's hope that at least we learn our lessons from this one.
Right. Well, hopefully we, yes. I guess that's my ending note. I think that we have to get better. And there's many signs that we can, and there are other ways of doing things. And collectively, I think that we just have to do better than what has happened the past half a year.
Agreed. Thank you so much for chatting with us today, Marta.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Erin. I'm glad I've had this opportunity to talk with you a little bit.
The Story Collider is so grateful to Marta for sharing her knowledge and to Mary Sue for sharing her story. Story Collider is also very grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. This podcast series is produced by me, Erin Barker, with assistance from Story Collider's Deputy Director Nissa Greenberg and Senior Podcast Editor Jun Chen. Special thanks goes out to Story Collider's board, our Operations Manager Lindsay Cooper, and our Interim Executive Director Leslie Griesbach-Schultz, without whom none of this would be possible. The story featured in the first part of this episode was produced by Senior Producer Catherine J. Wu. The theme music is by Eva Gertz of the Fulton Street Music Group. Stay tuned for two more stories in part two of Generations on Monday. Until then, this is Story Collider signing off. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, love each other. Thank you for listening.
My name is Jeff Zimmerman, and I swear to Christ, if I hear the word pivot one more time, I'm going to fill my N95 mask with vomit. I'm a stand-up comic and storyteller, and I used to pay my bills teaching storytelling to performers and businesses. And I'd have told you I was going to have a great year if you'd have asked me on March 1st. And listen, I'm not trying to start a suffering contest here. 2020 has completely sucked for everybody. So this podcast is called The Reluctant Phoenix. I'll be having conversations with people in my life and beyond who have restarted their lives whether or not they really wanted to in the first place. And all I'm saying is that even if a phoenix is supposed to catch on fire to be reborn, I bet it screams like hell on the way out. So please, subscribe now to The Reluctant Phoenix, available wherever the very finest podcasts are digitally distributed.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.